It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Early speculation on the 2016 Republican presidential nominee contenders has a good number of people, of course, talking about Wisconsin's Scott Walker.
Well, the East Coast also has murmurs of Republican nominee material with New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie.
Staff writer at New York Magazine Ben Wallace Wells recently asked that question in an article, "What is Chris Christie doing right?"
And Ben, thanks for being with us.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
Well, you say Chris Christie has arguably become the most popular politician in the country. How so?
On the simple fact of his being popular, I mean, his approval ratings are astronomical. This is a guy who is, on policy positions, a pretty conservative governor in an extremely liberal state. And, you know, he has more Democrats who approve of his performance than not, nearly as many African Americans who approve of his performance as don't. I mean, that's sort of unheard of for a Republican. I think that, you know, there are a lot of things that Christie's been able to do, but one of them that has been rare among moderate Republicans is to bring a real populist energy to a moderate politics. And, you know, there is a really extraordinary theater of Christie on the trail. Every event is sort of an event, you know, and people come expecting him to pick a fight with some obscure, usually Democratic, sometimes Republican figure, and he does, he delivers. There's a tremendous feeling of fun and combat that he's able to generate.
And it's interesting because you mentioned that populist energy he brings to events, and, you know, YouTube is rife with Christie events out there. But, you know, in a political world right now where everybody is so polarized, what is it, you know, and he is not, I mean, he is as blunt as they come and maybe even blunter. And yet, as you say, he is the most popular politician in the country in some ways right now. How does that happen? You know, I mean, because by rights, if you were almost any other politician, you would see that split and people would take a side and other people would take another side.
I think one thing that he's been able to do is be blunt without being partisan and be blunt without being ideological, you know, and part of the, you know, there's some theater to this, but part of what he's been able to do is to create such a cult of personality in the state that he can, you know, sort of defy normal ideological and normal partisan expectations and lines and kind of get away with it. I mean, you saw that in, you know, probably his most public national moment, which was his embrace of President Obama after Sandy, they called the superstorm on the East Coast, basically not quite a hurricane, but very devastating, you know, where he sort of said, screw you to Fox News and members of the Republican establishment who expected that he would, you know, bash Obama and come out in support of Romney. You know, Christie has always been able to give a sense of a man on a mission that runs through politics and tangent to it, but is not, you know, not quite captured by the normal divides and debates.
Well, he has this outsized personality. It's a huge personality. You said there's this theatricality to him that people respond to. But I wonder, you know, you'd look at someone like Howard Dean, who seemed to have an excess of personality, and it didn't work out so well for him. What's the difference?
I think that you know, remains to be seen what happens with Chris Christie nationally. I mean, Howard Dean looked awfully good for a period of time. I guess I would say that Chris Christie has forged his personality in a place whose politics demand that he speak to people who do not necessarily agree with him. You know, and there is, you know, something I think pretty powerful to be said for sort of training yourself politically in a climate that is diverse, that is different from your own politics. I mean, you know, here's a guy who, has to figure out a way to sell his opposition to gay marriage in a state that favors it overwhelmingly. Here's a guy who has to figure out how to sell an economic policy that, you know, is pretty slanted against the poor and the middle class in a state that, though incredibly rich, tends to favor more, you know, more redistributionist economic policies. And so, you know, we have a politics right now that is deeply siloed geographically, you know, where you can, in both the Democratic and Republican Party, come up and make it pretty far without, you know, having to convince many voters who don't naturally agree with you. And the accident of Christie's, you know, birth, and a man has never left New Jersey. The accident of his Jerseyness means that he has had to do something a little bit more difficult and more complicated. But you know, I don't think that Christie is, you know, Christie is not an obvious fit within the Republican Party right now, and he's not necessarily a natural, you know, candidate for president. So it sort of remains to be seen what happens to him on a national stage. But in the context of New Jersey, he's been incredibly, incredibly successful.
Yeah, you talk about his Jerseyness in the article, and it's for people who have not been exposed to Chris Christie a lot, or maybe just in the last year or two, the Jerseyness seems extraordinarily genuine as you watch him. But that theatrical nature of how he's learned to be in public and how he deals with the press and with other politicians and so forth, has he always been that way, or has there been a shift in sort of that theatrical nature of being?
He's been worse. You know, I mean, early in his career, when he was very young, when he was in his late 20s, he ran as a sort of insurgent Republican candidate for a seat on the county board of supervisors in Morris County, New Jersey, which is kind of a very wealthy suburban county where he was living and working as a lawyer at the time. His wife works on Wall Street, still does. You know, he came in, the board was Republican dominated, and he came in as a kind of loud, clanging, you know, reform candidate, demanding that people, you know, disclose where they got their campaign contributions. There were, you know, very minor but kind of shady deals between the county government and various contractors, and he was very aggressive about trying to expose them. And he had such a kind of acute and keen and hostile sense of righteousness that, you know, he got himself booted off of the board of supervisors, and for, you know, a number of years, people in New Jersey thought his political career was over, that he was just simply too abrasive and too self-satisfied, self-promoting, self-involved to be an effective politician. He managed through a series of connections with friends of his who he'd worked with in sort of lobbying circles in Trenton to get himself a position sort of raising funds for the Bush presidential campaign in 2000, and was enormously, enormously successful at that, and then was appointed by George W. Bush when he became president over many more sort of experienced candidates to be U.S. Attorney for New Jersey, which, because of New Jersey's sort of singular and delightful history of corruption, is just an incredible launching point for any political career. And that made him, it was a post that really suited Christie, because he could go, you know, all out at a culture that was genuinely, you know, corrupt and problematic, that of, you know, dealing urban politicians. And he was very aggressive, and he was very stagey and very showy, and he made a real name for himself. But no, I mean, I say that there's an element of theatricality to his political presentation. That's definitely true. It's definitely a practiced persona, but it's not a new or an ungenuine persona. Chris Christie, you know, for better or for worse, is who he is.
We're talking with Ben Wallace Wells right now, contributing editor at New York Magazine, about his article about the popularity of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. And we want to know what you think about how Chris Christie has managed to become a widely popular politician in an age of political polarity. What do you think it takes to make somebody popular? And does Chris Christie have something Scott Walker does or doesn't have? And how do you like a stack up between Walker and Christie, maybe in 2016, who knows? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking right now with Ben Wallace Wells, contributing editor at New York Magazine, about the popularity of Chris Christie and taking a look at how he's managed to become so popular and what his chances are as we go down the road and looking at a possible presidential bid in 2016. And wondering what you think. What is your take on Chris Christie? Do you see him as a leader of the country? You see him rising to the top of the Republican hopefuls? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Ben, I want to ask you, you write about the way that politicians use anger as part of their political persona, as part of the political toolkit, but that Chris Christie uses it in a different way. How does he use his anger?
He uses it sort of as a rallying cry. I mean, there is, when you're out on the trail with Christie, what he will do at virtually every event is that he will pick a particular person who's sort of standing in the way of progress, and it's usually some very small, very minor figure, a state senator or a mayor or something like that, and he will name that person. And he will, explain an issue through this politics of very aggressive personal combat. At one point, he said of a 78-year-old widowed state senator named Loretta Weinberg. He sort of moaned to the press, said, "I hope you guys take a bat to her." The very very aggressive imagery of combat. But I think what he is able to do by making his politics so personal is to sort of is to kind of pick up people who might not agree with him, to focus anger not at broad institutions, broad ideological categories, not at conservatives, not at the banks on Wall Street, but at people who are very, 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 very close to home. And so in a state, and part of the reason that Christie is, there's a lot that remains to be seen about him as a national figure is so much of his grammar and vocabulary is so Jersey. But in a state where, things are going great. I mean, people make fun of New Jersey all the time, but it's, for the last 15 years, it's been among the two or three wealthiest states in the union by any measure. The educational attainment of its kids is incredible. That's a kind of message, that people are willing to hear, not, be furious about all politics or be furious about Washington or be furious about Wall Street and the banks, but you're almost there. You as a state are just about where you need to be, and there's just this like one idiot, this one state senator, this one mayor who's holding you back. So it's a interesting way of playing with and manipulating anger. But his whole persona in politics is a theater of anger, channeling and sort of management. Everything with Christie is done through anger.
Although, during the Hurricane Sandy and his response to that, we sort of saw the soft side of Chris Christie.
Incredibly so. I mean, it was we saw it even more here on the East Coast. But, he was so one of the things that I think Christie understands is the sentimentality that people in a vastly wealthy state feel for a time when things were simpler. So he's a very famous Bruce Springsteen fan, and he, goes nuts at all the concerts, and he's been to something like 120 concerts at this point. And he has that feeling, that kind of, nostalgia for small town working class New Jersey, and he can channel it very effectively. There are these moments in the aftermath of that storm where he's walking through the Jersey Shore, which is itself, not the Hamptons in New York or Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, but a very working man's holiday kind of place. And he's got the eyes of the whole media on him in the middle of this presidential campaign, and he's reminiscing about a sausage and pepper stand that he used to visit that blew away, and he's remembering the house he crammed into with 11 roommates when he was in college, and that he was in that moment, and he has been incredibly diligent. I mean, even this summer, he's down at the Jersey Shore talking about the aftermath of Sandy, you know, seems like every couple of days. He's been incredibly diligent about trying to fix that place and trying to maintain that sort of more sentimental, softer, more nostalgic persona. One way I think that this sort of plays into Republican politics nationally is at the outset of every Republican presidential contest, we tend to do two things. We tend to assume that the most conservative candidate is going to carry the primary, and we tend to forget that women vote in the Republican primary too. And so what you see in Mitt Romney and John McCain are candidates, and in George W. Bush are sort of the rare candidate in the Republican field who's able to attract as many votes from women as from men. And, you know, in presidential contest after presidential contest, the Republican electorate has started out looking like it will send the most conservative candidate or one of the most conservative candidates to Washington. It hasn't always ended up trying to do that. And I think that, you know, Christie is, you know, again, he's got huge problems in a national context, but you know, there's something there, and there's an appeal that is sort of broad and matches the way that the Republican Party has in its primaries tended to go in the past.
Now, you've talked about his relatability and why it is he manages to be volatile and theatrical and angry and still sort of relatable and appealing to people. And I wonder if, you know, his weight has anything to do with that. It's been a popular subject, and I wonder if it helps him or it hurts him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it absolutely helps him. I mean, there is, one of the immediate problems that every politician has to have is distance, and is, you know, any person who's coming to ordinary folks and seeking their vote is sort of a member of a distant and foreign elite. And you know, Christie's simple mass, which is, you know, he had the stomach surgery, but he's still just an enormous human being, you know, is unavoidable and creates immediate sympathy in people who meet him and makes him seem a little bit closer, I think, and a little bit less distant. And you know, having something that people make fun of you for is actually not a bad way to start out in politics.
Well, speaking of distance, 2016 is right around the corner. And he, of course, is, you know, one of a number of Republicans who are talked about as being contenders for the presidency. And you've alluded to some challenges he might have on the national scene. And what are those? Just sort of the person that he is and trying to expand that persona?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a couple things. First of all, he's very, you know, publicly bipartisan. And, you know, he has at many points angered both the national Republican establishment and national Republican, sort of national conservative base because of his sort of public way in which he's, you know, pushed back against Speaker Boehner, against recently Rand Paul, against kind of you know, big Republican figures, and the public way in which he's reached out to Democrats. And you know, another problem is that, you know, he's never going to be the most conservative candidate in the field. He's done a good job, I think, in New Jersey at preserving a kind of plausibility as a conservative. You know, he's managed, and I think this is there's a lot of political talent involved here. But he's managed to, you know, be straight down the line against gay marriage. He's pro-life, though he was pro-choice earlier in his political career. You know, on economic issues, he's been pretty conventionally pretty conventionally conservative, though he does see maybe a broader role for government than maybe Scott Walker does, and so, you know, he's in a party that is very very partisan right now and also pretty conservative. He is not at all partisan and not very conservative, so those are problems. And yes, I mean, I think that, you know, if you predicate your every political campaign you've ever run on picking fights with people. You know, like that may play better in a political campaign for governor that lasts effectively 6 months than one for president that lasts 3 years. I think one question for Christie is just, you know, and this killed Rudy Giuliani, who was a
I've got about 5 seconds left for you.
Okay, who was a lesser politician but had a similar politics. It's just, you know, how much can people take of this? You know, I mean,
all right, Ben, thank you so much, but we're out of time. Appreciate you joining us this hour.
Sure.
That was Ben Wallace Wells, contributing editor at New York Magazine.
Coming up next is the news, and then we'll check in with a reporter who covered President Obama's speech this morning on accessibility in higher education. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, here today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll try and solve the mystery of how a 10-foot-tall bronze statue went missing in Milwaukee. That's the subject of today's Curious Wisconsin segment.
But first, President Obama announced new proposals today aimed at making colleges more accountable and affordable by rating them and ultimately linking those ratings to financial aid.
Now, the president has said that making college affordable is a personal mission, as he's pledged to shake up the current system. But the question is, will Congress ultimately side with him?
Joining us to talk about the president's plan is Colleen McCain-Nelson. She's the White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and she's currently traveling with the president. Colleen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the crux of this new plan is the creating of a rating systems for colleges. Tell me what you know about how that will work.
Well, it's a kind of a brand new idea. The president wants to create a rating system. He wants to collect all sorts of data, looking at how good of a value each college is. What are the graduation rates? What are the transfer rates? Do they get disadvantaged students to graduate? How much do graduates earn after they leave college? He wants to use a wide range of data sets to determine how good a value each college is. And then he eventually wants to ask Congress to tie those ratings to the allocation of financial aid, so that if you get a good rating, you will get more access to financial aid. Students who go to your schools will be able to get larger Pell Grants and better interest rates on loans.
Now, a good rating would mean what? That your college doesn't cost a ton of money and that its graduates do relatively well?
Well, the president keeps using the word value, and so a number of different things would go into assessing that. And affordability is certainly one aspect of that. Getting students to graduate is another aspect of that. The president points out that right now, colleges essentially just get money largely based on how many students they enroll, and there's not as much follow-up to consider, are these students that are getting this money, are they actually completing college, are they graduating, are they learning what they need to learn and getting good jobs afterwards? So he says, hold colleges more accountable for actually educating students and getting good results. But as many people have pointed out today, the devil will be in the details, and exactly how the rating system works remains to be seen because it's yet to be developed.
Now, some of these data points that he's talking about including, they're not that contentious. Some of the information is out there already, but some of them are things that are new, such as, I think, how much graduates might earn afterward. Which ones are contentious?
Right. Well, that certainly is a question mark, how much graduates will earn. And higher education experts have pointed out that not all of this data is collected at this moment and may not be readily available. So there are certainly a lot of data sets that exist that would be available immediately to create this rating system, but questions remain about how this other data would be collected, where it would come from, how you would track some of these things. And so so everyone is still kind of assessing how this might work, and there are a lot of unanswered questions.
Do you have a sense about why President Obama is introducing this plan right now?
Well, that's an excellent question. He certainly has a lot of other issues on his plate at the moment. You know, he wants to get immigration reform passed. He needs to get people to sign up for his new healthcare law. He has a lot going on in the world, in Syria and Egypt and other places. But the White House says that the president is speaking honestly when he says this really is a personal mission. He thinks this is very important, and he wants to start the process now. And I think one could argue that the president has a limited window of opportunity in his second term and needs to get things done relatively quickly. So knowing that Congress doesn't get a lot of things done relatively quickly, I think he wanted to put this idea out there as soon as he could.
What's the reaction been so far?
Well, the reaction has been mixed so far. Not surprisingly, some Republicans on Capitol Hill already have come out against the plan and have said, you know, that the answer is not the answer to every problem is not to give more power to Washington bureaucrats. Among colleges and universities and higher education experts, we've heard some praise for the president encouraging innovation and challenging colleges to get good results. But they've also raised some questions and some have expressed some opposition, particularly on the front of where this data will come from, how it will be collected.
Now, one thing that's important to the president is that tuition for colleges gets tapered off a little bit. He seems to feel that it's been running away. And so it sounds like he's got some bits of this proposal that's urging colleges to experiment with new ways of reducing costs. Did he give any details about what that might look like?
Right. A couple ideas that he offered up were creating more accelerated three-year degree programs, saying that colleges should focus more on what students are learning and not how many hours they're actually spending in the classroom. He also wants to see more innovation with online classes, particularly large online classes that are free and widely available to huge numbers of people. And he really wants colleges to take some chances and try some new things and to encourage competition among colleges. And so he's hopeful that if he can kind of peel away some of the regulations that might have been standing in the way of innovation, that some new ideas will come forward and help ultimately make college more affordable.
Now, you said that this is personal for President Obama. Do you have a sense about why that is and why it matters so much?
I think part of it is this summer he has really turned his focus to the middle class. He's been on a tour across the country rolling out a series of proposals, all of which have been focused on improving life for the middle class. And so this is part of that rollout of a wide range of proposals. But also, President Obama talks a lot about the student loans that both he and wife Michelle Obama took out to go to college and then to go to grad school. And he notes that they were still paying off their loans when they were in their 40s, right up until the time that he was running for the U.S. Senate. And he said, you know, we were still paying our loans at a time when we should have been saving for college for our daughters, not still paying off our own education from years and years ago.
Do you have a sense about, you know, we talked a little bit about how Congress responded, what some Republicans have said, about just people in the audience, general people on the street, if they think this is a good idea?
Well, I think that it's hard to argue that making college affordable is a good idea. There's strong support for that, and so I think that this is an issue that gets really high ratings among voters, and they will tell you that they're interested in seeing what the president could do to make that happen. Republicans, of course, who might oppose the president's plan in the details, also will say that they too want to make college more affordable. So I guess it comes down to the details. I think there's a wide agreement that a lot of families simply can't afford to send their kids to college and that something should be done about that. But how to accomplish that remains the sticking point when you delve deeper into the conversation. But the president's message today is he says that college should be an imperative and not a luxury.
Now, as you talked about, there is a lot on President Obama's docket in the second term. How does this fit in priority-wise?
Well, I think the White House would say that this is a key priority and that the economy is their number one priority, and this kind of falls under the umbrella of improving the economy, making life better for the middle class. And so it's a large umbrella that encompasses a number of different things, focused on job creation, focused on housing proposals, focused on higher education. And so I think they would shy away from putting these in rank order. But their message this summer has been that the economy is the focus, and that the president wants to see the middle class succeed and make it possible for people to be a little more mobile economically.
All right. Well, Colleen, thank you so much for joining us, and I'll let you get back to writing about the president.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That was Colleen McKay-Nelson, a White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and she's currently traveling with the president.
Coming up next, it is Curious Wisconsin. We'll be exploring how a 10-foot-tall bronze statue disappeared from Milwaukee and where it might be now. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We recently came across an article in Urban Milwaukee about the disappearance of a 10-foot-tall statue named Germania, and that is going to be the subject of today's Curious Wisconsin segment.
The statue was on the Germania building at 2nd and Wells in downtown Milwaukee from 1896 until it was removed secretly in the night.
That was back in 1918, and that really is where the mystery starts. Brian Jacobson joins us now to talk about the disappearance and what happened after that. He's a freelance writer in Milwaukee. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you along. I think this is a terrific story. And how did you come across it?
Well, I have to tell you that the germ for the story really started about 6 years ago. And it was because I was looking at a lot of old postcards of Milwaukee. And I would come across ones that had really fantastic fountains and monuments. And I'd be like, well, wait a minute, I know that park. Where is that elk statue? And I finally decided on five different items that I wanted to try and find. And out of those, I managed to find the other four, and the fifth one was the Germania statue. And I just could not find it and could not find it, so I sort of just gave up on the idea. And it wasn't until recently that I decided to just sit down a couple of times with Russell Zimmerman, who did the most extensive research on the subject for the new building's owners in 1981, and try and use the internet to, you know, use all those new resources to see if there was maybe further things that I could find.
Boy, nothing like a good mystery to really get you fired up, huh?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So take us back to when the building that the Germania statue was on. Take us back kind of to that time in Milwaukee's history. Of course, a lot of German history there, if you think of Schlitz, Pabst, and I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. Talk a little bit about that building and then the statue that sort of graced it.
Sure. Well, the building itself was, you know, sort of the culmination of going from rags to riches for George Brumder. In the Brumder family, George was the 15th out of 16 kids. He came over to America when he was 18 to see his sister get married to a Lutheran minister, and he decided to stay in Wisconsin and work as a farmer for a while, and then he laid down the tracks for the streetcars here in Milwaukee. And he finally opened up a bookshop and met his wife at Grace Lutheran Church, and they started doing book selling and also printing, especially of German books and hymnals and Bibles. And so they became very rich within a very short period of time, enough so that he was able to build the tallest office building in Milwaukee at the time, this neoclassical Beaux-Arts structure. Eight stories tall. At the time, in 1896, it was like a lot of the other buildings, had very German features. This time, there's these giant green copper domes on top of the building that look like Kaiser helmets. And, you know, for 20, 25 years, it was the pride and joy of a major population here in Milwaukee. And he had commissioned, when it was built, Carl Keynes, who was a sculptor that made a lot of famous statues, to make an exact replica of a monument that's over in Germany, and that was the Germania statue. And it, for the 25 years, it was a pride and joy, and it wasn't until World War I that it became a problem.
And it became a problem, of course, because of the American entrance into World War I and anti-German sentiment, not just in Milwaukee, but anywhere there was anything remotely German. You know, street names were changing, old German names were falling by the wayside, and right here in Milwaukee, you've got this great big statue just sort of sitting there, and it made some people unhappy.
That's right. You know, like a lot of other cities, like you said, you know, street names changed, and the language itself kind of was spoken in alleyways to each other during that short time period. And there was a Canadian, a British war recruiting officer that had his office right across the street from it, and he just had to look at it every day, and he was so upset by it that he would keep going to the Milwaukee Journal and saying, that's a terrible, terrible thing in this town, and we have to take it away. And so the Brumders, by that time George had passed away and his sons had taken over, and William C. Brumder had managed to go to UW, Wisconsin College, and was on the first football team, and he was a Republican. He was very American, and he agreed that, you know, for the sake of the business, they would get rid of the statue. And so that's where he took a family friend, Cyril Kolnick, who was a very famous ironwork artist here in Milwaukee, him and his crew in the middle of the night to take the statue down and hide it. And unbeknownst to everybody, he hid it in his studio for the next 20 years.
So it sat in his studio for an awfully long time, and he knew it was there, obviously. And then since then, it sort of it disappears and then surfaces every so often. Can you kind of take us through the next few decades?
Sure. Well, after it disappeared after World War I, nobody just ever talked about it again in the newspapers or anywhere. And it sat in the corner collecting the dust from the forges where they were making the ironwork in the shop. He had a very famous little shop on 8th and Kilbourne, which is where MacArthur Square Park is now. And in 1936, one of the Milwaukee Journal columnists wrote a story where he imagined going over there in the middle of the night and the statue coming to life. And he had a conversation with a lady, and she was this very haughty lady, and she would ask about politics and things that were going on. And then the sun came up, and she turned back into a statue. And it was the first time that anybody had said, oh, that's where she is. And you know, instead of hauling her out the next couple of years, you know, and being anti-German was popular again because with the rise of Hitler and then the entrance into World War II came along. But before that, in 1940, she was borrowed out for the first time ever to a convention that was happening at the Milwaukee Auditorium. But afterwards, she was laid down in the basement horizontally and then just forgotten about for another couple of years.
But then all of a sudden, there was that big scrap drive during World War II where people were looking for any kind of metal they could get. And here you've got 3 tons worth of metal there. There's some speculation that she wound up in the scrap heap.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the conclusion that I don't necessarily spell out in the article, but that's what I pretty much fear happened to her, because this guy, W.E. Simons, who ended up becoming this regional director for Wisconsin and just made a very rapid rise for how successful he was in getting scrap metal for the war effort, wanted the statue. And then he was told by Washington, stop melting everything down. You're being silly.
Because he was melting down anything of historic value, art, it really didn't matter. If it was metal, it was going to the war, right?
Yeah, he convinced an entire community to melt down their pedestrian bridge that went over a river.
He was good at what he did. We have to give him that.
He was. But he was unsuccessful, supposedly, in this mark. By this time, Cyril Kolnick was in poor straits. You know, for such a famous and wonderful artist, he was having a hard time because the county government had taken his shop because they wanted the land, and his wife dies, and he has to move with his daughter into this little tiny space, and so he doesn't have the means to take her back, and he also realizes it's a piece of art, and he shouldn't just be taking $700 for something that was, you know, cost $7,500 to make back in 1896. It was probably worth $10,000, you know, or more in World War II. And so, you know, that's the last anybody ever heard of. It was in this article that said Washington told W.E. Simon stop melting things down, and Kolnick said that he would take an offer for the statue, but not for what the scrap dealers were offering.
So after all of your research, after everything, after every internet rock you could turn over, you've pretty much come to the conclusion that she was turned into a tank or bullets or something.
Yeah, Russ Zimmerman told me a story that he never wrote about in his article, and that's because it's all fourth-hand rumor, which is all we have to go on now, in which a woman who was a secretary that worked at the auditorium and just randomly told one of the docents at the Germania building that would show people around, she's like, yes, I worked at the auditorium. It was so sad to see her arm hanging out of the end of a gondola cart, which kind of gives you the conclusion that they broke her apart.
Wow, what a great story. So you're going to be keeping your eyes open, though. I mean, she still could turn up someplace, although it's hard to hide something like that.
Yeah, I went into crazy detail, and I have to give my respect to Bruce Murphy for helping me turn this into a real story for Urban Milwaukee, because I just put every bit of detail into the original versions. And I did crazy research that Russ had never done out on Pine Lake, where a lot of the Brumders moved after World War II.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that mystery right there. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. All right. Thank you.
Brian Jacobson is a freelance writer in Milwaukee.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the importance of having a national conversation about depression and how we can talk honestly about the subject.
Meanwhile, tomatoes are all over farmers' markets and in your gardens right now. We'll be talking with a food writer about making some great summer salsas.
And we'll get a roundup of the top state news stories with WPR News guy Noah Ofshinsky.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.